Uh-huh.
Okay. I will call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting on this Tuesday, April 10, 2012. I would ask the audience to join the board as we honor our nation with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone. We appreciate almost a full house. It's always exciting for us to have so many of you here. The next item is consideration of minutes of 3:27:12 and 4:03:12.
Move approval of the minutes.
Second.
Been moved and second to approval of the minutes. Are there any comments or additions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. Now it's the time for public comments. This is an opportunity for members of the audience to address the board concerning topics on today's agenda. We're pleased that we have received two notices here, and I'm not sure if there will be more that wants to discuss with the board. First of all, we have Dr. Frank Riddle? Okay. All right. Please come on up. I think you will refer that yours relates to the secondary road five-year plan and so forth. So, great. Welcome.
I just wanted to speak today as a member of the Gilbert City Council and a citizen of the city of Gilbert with kids in the Gilbert School about safety issues on the road referred to Gretton or Grant Avenue south of Gilbert. Traveling the road extensively myself into and out of the town with increased traffic when Highway 69 is closed for construction this summer and potentially increased traffic after the high school is completed fall of 2013. I'm concerned that that road, the way it sits today, is very dangerous to kids, high school kids that are leaving to or coming from the high school. And with the five-year plan not including that road as a potential paving product, I'd urge the engineer and the supervisors to give that more consideration, possibly put it higher up on the list of projects within the county.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. I believe we have also, is it Tanya Austin? Come on down.
Thank you. This might be a little redundant, but I represent the Gilbert School Board on behalf of the Gretton Street paving as well. Currently, right now, I think this project has shifted from a want to a need. There were times when this used to be, wouldn't it be great if we could make it directly to there, or convenience, efficiency. But I really think now with our growth, we're at a 7% annual increase right now, the rate that we're going, and with our new high school being built on that school or on that road, I just think it's imperative for the safety of the kids, for the safety of the district and the patrons that come into that. Gilbert is really a campus community. Therefore, most of our traffic is coming in because of school events and activities. So I really want to encourage you to be creative with how we can get this project completed for the safety of our kids. Again, the quality of life that we offer in Gilbert, and just ask that you take that under consideration today.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else that want to talk, mention something on this topic? Yes. Not that topic. No, I mean this topic regarding the paving of Gretton or extension of Grant yet. No. Okay. Yeah, it's on the agenda, but we're going to call on you. I just want to find out and make sure that no one else wanted to comment on this one before we go to you, Nancy. Okay? Seeing no one, then come on down. Welcome back, Nancy Miller. Okay. Okay.
I just have some praise and some recommendation.
I saw on the consent agenda that we've got a whole number of adopt a road things. And interestingly, I saw an advertisement on TV regarding that subject. And I would hope that there would be some way, maybe through additional schools, different levels of schools and civic organizations and so on, to promote doing that. You know, perhaps there could be something on the website as to what adopter roads have been taken to encourage additional people from to do that. I think that's a great service to the entire county. And the other thing I wanted to mention is Central Iowa Works. I don't know how many of you had an opportunity to go on Central Iowa Works website, but I was extremely impressed with the quality and the number of businesses that are participating in that function. And I already mentioned the galas, as you know. I think that the information about this definitely should be posted at minimum at every one of the unemployment terminals, because too many times these things are available and people don't know about it. And so I think that the word needs to get out extensively.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your suggestion. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the board regarding a topic on today's agenda during this first public forum portion? Okay. Seeing no one, then thank you. And we, the board, will certainly take to heart the comments and suggestions. Okay, moving on down the line, let me first of all notify the public. We are going to kind of change the agenda somewhat. After we are done with the public hearing portion, we have a request from two of our department heads that they must leave and get to another very important function. And so we're going to, after the public forum one, I'm going to move items 3, 9, and 10 to be dealt with so that both Gayla and Deb can attend another function, and then we'll go back to the agenda from that point on as outlined. So hopefully you can bear with us as we make this change to accommodate another important meeting that those individuals need to be at. So with that, we're ready for public hearing item number one, consideration of ordinance 214, amending the floodplain management program for the unincorporated area of Story County. Planning and Development Director Leanne Harder.
And she makes it to the chair unassisted. Nice.
Very proud of myself. Thank you. Quite simply, this is an ordinance being brought forward to you today for first consideration to amend the floodplain management ordinance to strike all the instances of the Planning and Zoning Department and replace it with Planning and Development Department or the Planning and Development Director. Same thing that was done with the Land Development Regulations last fall. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Straightforward, I think.
Yeah. I move approval of first consideration.
No.
Public hearing.
It's a public hearing.
I'm trying to get through it.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? Hearing none. Okay. At this time, I will open the public hearing portion and ask if there's anyone that would like to speak to Ordinance 214. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing portion. And now, board, you're ready.
Go ahead.
And we have to have a second reading of this, don't we?
You have to have a second. But you can leave the third.
Okay. I would move approval of the changes to the floodplain management ordinance and set the second reading for Tuesday, April 24th.
Second.
It's been moved in second to approve Ordinance 214 on first reading and set the second reading for the 24th, Tuesday morning. For further consideration. Any further comments? Hearing none. Toot?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Clinton? Aye. Ordinance 214 on first consideration is adopted, and we'll move to the second consideration on the 24th for final disposition. Leanne, as a point of order, if we receive no other comments or question, it's possible that we could waive the third one. Is that correct? That is an option. Okay. Just keep that in mind, then. Thank you. Okay. All right. Then moving on down, item number three is discussion and consideration of positions to transfer service between the Richmond Center and CLP. Director Gayla Harkin. Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much for moving me about. I appreciate that a lot. I wanted to clarify that we're not talking about transferring positions from the Richmond Center and CLP. We're talking about considering positions to accommodate the capacity for the transfer of clients that the Richmond Center is presently serving that are looking to come over as part of their outreach program to our outreach program and social development groups, et cetera. So I just wanted to clarify that because this kind of relates back to the memorandum of understanding that you folks have on the consent agenda, which is about ensuring that the persons who are wanting to continue services in an outreach capacity have the opportunity to do that with us. They're going to go through the normal interview process and referral process, but if they select a different provider, that's certainly okay. That's important that I say that because at this point we have, I think, 14 or 15 actual referrals. There can be as many as up to 80 people coming in for services, and we are in the process. Michelle De La Riva and I are going to visit after this meeting, too, about how we can help coordinate this with Deb's department, with community services, to make that transition go as smoothly as possible for those people that want that. So what I'm here to request is the approval of up to three FTEs to potentially deal with this influx of people. Whether or not I will actually need to fill those, I won't know until I know exactly how many bodies we have referred, what our capacity internally is to absorb. Because we don't know all these clients, I don't know what level of support they're necessarily going to require.
Is it fair to equate the if there were fully 80 that came over, that would equate more to the three full-time positions?
Yeah, we would definitely, if the full 80 came, we would definitely need to expand by three.
Can you describe to me really quickly how the funding follows these people? So if this board approves up to the three full-time positions, we're not encumbering county dollars that have already been put elsewhere.
There would be a transfer of dollars that are now going to the Richmond Center to pay for some of those services that then would come to us for some of those people who are county supported. We would also, part of this transition process is that they would need to work back through community services with Deb's department to be approved for habilitation funding, which is through Medicaid. So those dollars and from Medicaid would come to us. On the short haul, we do have some funds still in our budget for personnel because we're still waiting to get up and going with another apartment site. So we have some overlap in some funds available to help us bridge that transition so we're not going in the hole, so to speak, by bringing anybody
Absolutely.
On.
And I appreciate that. And so if I look at it short-term and long-term, if we approve the possibility of these positions short-term, we're not having to go find any additional county money. It's already money that has been approved to be used for these kind of purposes that we can utilize here.
Exactly.
And long term, there's enough funding, both federal, state, and county, that's already being used in this area that comes back to fund these positions.
I can tell you that today, the way I understand how the system is going to be funded, that would be my answer.
And all of that is, all of that, I guess I should preface with, depending on what the state does.
Yeah.
We would not be committing the county to spending more dollars than we're already spending.
That's right. That's right. So it's my request that we have the latitude to do that. One of the things that we're very concerned about is making sure that the transfer is seamless and that people don't go without services who truly need them. So we feel that we need to be at the ready to go hand in hand with this partnership.
Well, and I felt like that was one of the things. While we didn't formally commit to that, as we decided along with our partners in Asset to go about this transition, we committed to the idea that we were not going to leave this population holding the bag without services for any amount of time. So to me, this appears to be just the administrative portion of staying good to what we said we were going to do when we talked about making this transition. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't committing dollars that we don't have to do something.
And then another factor to think about it was in previous situations, county programs and offerings, we tried to not be duplication of services that was also competing with other private contractors and so forth, such as the Richmond Center. So in this case, it was prudent for us to look at, are there services that we could pick up to provide for our clients and so forth during this transition phase? And this is where Gail and Deb have been looking closely at what programs that we have had in the past, but, you know, would be able to allow for this transition to be in a very seamless manner. So I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the diligence that you've put forth in this regard. However, what is the potential timeline for this to happen, assuming that everything goes as smoothly as you are anticipating, if we approve it?
The referrals have already started.
Okay.
And it was hoped that we could accomplish this in 30 days. I think that is extraordinarily ambitious. Our hope truly is to have things absolutely wrapped up on that front and every contact made with clients who may need to make a change, may want to do something different, et cetera, within 60 days is kind of realistically how I'm thinking that this actually has to go. We're going to hit it like we're doing it. The memorandum of understanding says that we'd like to do this within 30 days, and I think that it states that we're going to attempt to. It doesn't lock us into that, because I think realistically to do a quality job of it, we still have to have some time to get people converted from one system to another and to make those acquaintances, to get a plan laid out, know exactly how much resource that it's going to take to do it and to do it so that people have what they truly need.
Additional questions for Gail at this time? Okay. This does require, there was discussion and there is a possibility of action taken at this time for the approval of the three FTEs as suggested. So, Board, what is your pleasure?
I would move that we approve Gail's request to hire up to three additional full-time employees, depending on the number of transfer clients they get from the Richmond Center.
Yeah, I'll second that and just ask that you work closely with Alyssa all the way through so that we make sure that we're following everything we need to follow.
It's been moved and second. The approval of up to three FTEs to allow for the transfer of service between the Richmond Center and CLP as outlined in discussion. Hearing no further comments, I will ask all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Gayla, for that. Mm-hmm. Item three. And then we'll just move on down. While you're still sitting here, do you want to just deal with CARP first, and then we can always come back with Deb, or do you want to pause and then let her go, and then you come back?
I've got the seat heated up.
Okay, you got the seat heated.
We'll just stay with
her. All right, why don't we do that? Okay, tell us about CARF, okay?
All right, we had our CARF survey. CARF stands for the Commission for Accreditation of Rehabilitation and Residential Facilities, done for us in February. It was the week of President's Day, and February 23rd and 24th. We received notification that we were given a three-year accreditation, and I believe all three of you were at the exit review with CARF, and so you're quite familiar with some of the things that they went over with us. Specifically, we are approved for community housing, community integration, supported living, community employment services, job development, job supports, job site training, employee development, employment planning services. And our accreditation is extended now until March of 2015. We had many very positive comments. And I'm not sure, did you receive a copy, actually, of the report? Did CARF send one to you? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
I don't think I've seen one.
I haven't seen
one. Okay, well, then I made you a copy that you can have the actual copy of it. But in a nutshell, you know, they went through a variety of areas that they felt that we were very strong in, performance evaluations, the facilities, services, plans, and things like that for clients, the jail diversion program, individualized services, how we're planning and progressing in uncertain times with the legislative changes was noted as a strength, our alarm systems, how we transition people from one level of support to another, always moving toward the least restrictive, our supervision aspect, our internal policies on how we handle client issues and things that come up, the safety and crisis planning, those sorts of things were mentioned. And they have a list of things that we needed to make some improvements on. And these can kind of be clustered. I was happy with the things that they found. Not that I'm ever happy that they find things. But they're going to find things. So one of the areas that encompassed several notes that we needed to address was that although we collected and dealt with information on safety drills, on incident reports and things like this, and we review those every week and have a summary of how those are dealt with, we did not compile those in an annual report that could be attached to our annual outcome report. So we'll do that. All it will take is for us to copy off those reports, and then they'll be incorporated into our annual report. They'd like us to post the rights of persons served in conspicuous places. We'll make sure that we do that. We review those and people sign off on that, that they understand that. But we'll make sure that we post those. And they would like us to do more in the area of educating employers about working with persons with disabilities and what sorts of supports there are for that, and understanding better some of the laws around that. And we have been cited for not promoting tax incentives and things like that for persons with disabilities before. And every time I send in my note that, yes, we will make sure that we tell employers that we're willing and able to let them know that these things are available. But we have really promoted our services on the fact that we're promoting people who have abilities and not people who can be discounted or should be discounted. Philosophically, it's a point of divergence for me, and they accept that, and we get the okay. And I understand where they're coming from, but I really feel that it does a disservice. When I first got into this business, way back, we had people be hired who were part of work incentive programs, and they never attained, or very seldom were able to attain, full gainful employment. It was always seen as a lesser than, and I don't believe that that's what we want to stand for. So I think I met the letter of what they would like us to do. I'll make sure that employers know that we can do that. Am I going to go out and beat the drum for that? Probably not. So that really was the only one that I kind of went, I have to talk about that again.
I like the way you're doing things right now.
Oh, thank you. I think that they do, too. They understand, you know, philosophically where we're coming from. And I understand, too, that not every community is as open as ours is to hiring persons and working with us. So maybe that is something you'd have to use in another venue. But I feel very fortunate that our community, that has never been something that I had to use as a carrot to get people to be employed.
For the benefit of the other two board members, one of the bright spots of being a chair is that you get to be part of that interview process and visit with the staff a little bit about the relationship between the director and the board and things of this nature. And so I was able to go through quite a background of topics prior to their final report. And they also reached out to former board members. I believe Jane Halliburton was contacted. She was interviewed and so forth because of her long history with the CLP program and other members of the community. My assessment, after going through several of these over the last decade, this was probably the most thorough group that have come in that really took a critical look. And I think, as Gayla has indicated, is good as we think we may be, when they're able to look at some things and make some positive suggestions, it's a great thing. We always like to think about what are the industry standards out there that are practices that could serve our population better. And we take this as a positive rather than a negative. And I think this is, again, an outstanding report, but it was well received. And I think they felt extremely good about the entire operation that Story County has. And I think we have a lot to be proud of, and the citizens of Story County have a lot to be proud of as well. So thank you, Gayla, for that.
A huge credit to you and your staff. And even the one thing that stuck in my mind when we were in that room that day at the end, that the one individual made the comment about how impressed you was with the fleet of vehicles that we maintain in our facilities over there, and how well kept they are. And she said, you just don't generally see things kept to that standard when you're dealing with this type of an agency. It's, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just a testament to you and your staff. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for the good of cause?
I just want to say thank you to Nancy. She's right. The thing that's on your consent agenda about the Central Iowa Works looks like a great opportunity to partner with another entity to try to get more people employed and make that for us to work together. We have things that they want, and the employment industry has things that they want, and so together maybe we can forge a more formalized partnership through this. So she's right. It really is a neat opportunity.
Thank you. Okay. Then moving on to departmental report, community service. Deb, we had to pass on you last week because the board got quite long, and so welcome back. Okay.
Well, good morning, and thank you again for the adjustments to the agenda. I'm going to report on the community services activities for the period covering October of 2011 through February 2012. And on the copy that you have in that first table, I think the total for quarter says 93. Is that correct? Is that what yours is? It should be 108. So of that 108, we served in general assistance 54 single household cases and then 54 family cases, which brings our year-to-date total to 201. And that total for the quarter is up about 17% from the previous time. So, again, we continue to see folks coming through the doors needing help with basic needs. Under denials, we issued 410 during the quarter, and that's about a 35% increase from the previous reporting period. And then those who applied but did not return to complete our assistance process, there were 46, and that's about a 75% increase from the previous reporting period. So we have a lot of traffic through our doors. The primary types of assistance, rent, we paid out $40,135, utilities, $1,540, and miscellaneous, which would include medications, transportation, and burial, in the amount of $5,660. One of the reasons for the decrease in utility requests is because LIHEAP, Low-Income Heat Assistance Program, went into effect October 1st for elderly and then November 1st for disabled. That program is still in effect, and people can still apply through April 30th, and that's through the MICA office in Ames. Excuse me. SSI Interim Reimbursement Program, we averaged four people in this program. We assisted with rent and utilities while they're waiting for their SSI claims to be approved or denied. Our substance abuse program, we served 22 individuals during the quarter with a year-to-date total of 47 individuals. And this, the dollars that we spend is to cover hospitalization and court-related fees for people who are court-committed for treatment. And during the quarter, we spent $17,310. Under asset, we hit our busiest time during the reporting period. We had our panel hearings and work sessions in January, and final recommendations were turned over to the funders. The total amount allocated from all four funders for fiscal year 13 is $3,135,979, and the county's contribution towards that amount is about 30%, and that comes from three different funds within the county budget: general fund, MHDD, and local option. Under MHDD, our case management program averaged 345 clients a month that we served. We're working on about 9 referrals. We discharged 14 individuals, and the caseload size still averages about 31 per case manager. And we did have some staff changes during the reporting period. Jenny Ott joined our staff as a case manager in November, and she replaced Susan Kaler, who had been with us a little over 5 years. And then Penny Moberly, who was a case management supervisor, resigned the end of February, and we're working with HR in filling that position. Other activities, I'll kind of skip around here. The remodeling in the lower level of the Human Services Center is near completion, and we do have a move-in date now. It's April 23rd and 24th. And so we've worked with Al Hahn and Sandra Hunter with IT to coordinate those moving activities. And we will be closed for sure on the 23rd. We anticipate being closed on the 24th, but if things work out really well and we can open on the 24th, we'll open our doors or maybe even open half a day. So we plan on being packed up and ready to go first thing on the 23rd so facilities and IT can get our things moved. Community Services Network, that's our MIS system that is offered through ISAC and Spindustry. And Story County is currently a testing county for the case management module of that system. And we're hoping to work out the billing piece so that come July 1st, we'll be able to bill through that system and track claims and that sort of thing. So that's like the second phase of the Community Services Network is to add the case management module. So we're proud to be a testing county for that. And then last but not least, disability redesign and what's going on in the legislature with that. The main redesign bill is Senate File 2315, and it made it through the second funnel, and there have been a variety of House amendments dealing with funding, regions, and services. As of today, what I understand is the state will assume all the Medicaid costs for support services. So the counties have a non-federal share that we are mandated to cover right now, and the state will assume that non-federal share. I believe in fiscal year, they're talking fiscal year, part of fiscal year 13, but for sure moving into fiscal year 14. But counties will still be mandated to pay for mental health institutions, court commitments, resource centers, so Woodward and Glenwood, and then 12% of the private ICFMR facilities, like what Chrysalis operates here in Nevada. So we'll still have a small portion of that. Counties will also be responsible for non-Medicaid services in offering those services, and that'll give us a little bit of leeway and flexibility as far as what services we will be able to offer. There is a core list of services that has to be available in each region, or if a county is choosing to be on their own, the county has to offer that. So that's being finalized. one of the things that they removed from the regional discussion is there's no longer a population requirement. So if a county can meet the requirements of a region, they can request an exclusion from the Department of Human Services and be their own region. And there's a whole list of what those requirements are. So that's a change over the original bill. Financial responsibility, we're moving from legal settlement, that antiquated definition, to residency. And then they're also looking at a different way to levy dollars locally. Instead, right now we have the dollar cap of a little over $3 million. And what the state is proposing is a per capita levy based on the population. And here in Story County, what that would mean would be that they're identifying the per capita being at $47.50 per person. Our current per capita levy is in MHDD is $34.25. So how this is going to work is the county would still levy our $3 million. Our current levy, the state would come in and backfill the difference, which for Story County, it means about $1.6 million more. And so we would be relying on the state to provide those dollars. And in some of the spreadsheets that I've seen, it helps the larger counties. It helps some of the mid-sized counties, but the smaller counties have the higher levies now. Their levies would be reduced to this $47.50. And there'd be no mechanism in place for them to tap into extra dollars if they needed to tap into those dollars. And I think there was some unintended consequences when this levy conversation came up in the legislature, at least with a couple of local legislators that I talked to. So that's part of the discussion that's occurring this week, is this a workable solution? I don't know that it's a long-term solution. It could be a short-term fix, but I know in the legislature they're looking for long-term solutions to the entire system. So we'll have to wait and see where those discussions land. That's all I have for my report. Any questions?
Deb, while I have you here and also our financial guru there with Lisa Markley, when you talk about, and we discussed this a little bit yesterday, when we talk about our current capacity, and we're at 34.25 as far as our levy, and we understand the dollar cap, but the state is talking about a $47.50, would that mean that if a county so chose that they could go up to the $47.50 but not below, not above that, because that's where we're finding that those who are above the $47.50 now are going to have to pay back, not pay back, but in a sense, they're going to basically not receive additional state dollars and so forth, and this could jeopardize the level of service. But if a county just hypothetically decided that they would like to shift more of this towards the property tax, could they actually levy up to the $47.50 under this proposal rather than where we are?
Or levy above it? If their levy is
up to, I mean, this is, I assume, is that we're not at the max,
right,
technically.
Right, and they're not wanting this to be a tax increase to the local,
right,
property tax.
Exactly.
So that's why the state's coming in and saying, if you're below the $47.50, we'll make up the state will make up the difference. So we'll continue levying our little over $3 million, but then the state's going to come in and provide the $1.6 million that brings us up to that $47.50. Now, in those counties where they're above that $47.50, the way the legislation reads, it's assumed that they would have to be brought down to the $47.50.
Right.
Well, in some of those smaller counties, you get a couple of consumers who need some high-level needs and need a lot of services, that's a lot of money, you know, whether it's in a county or a region. So those counties are saying, well, the bill is silent in terms of allowing us to keep our current levy. So would that be a possibility? And that's part of the discussion that's going on at the State House, is if there's a county that's over that $47.50, can they choose to continue being over that $47.50 and bringing in those dollars? Because there will be no mechanism for them to draw state dollars. Does that answer your question?
Okay, yes, it does. Now, my question now relates to, how does that impact future ending fund balances Was there ever any discussion, because a lot of the state revenue that we receive now is tied a little bit to what the ending fund balance is. So if we're over a certain threshold, we get no state dollars. So was there any discussion regarding what that ending fund balance would have to be at?
The system that we now have in place that looks at fund balances would be replaced with this levy.
Gotcha.
As of today, ending fund balances are not going to be looked at. That's not to say that couldn't change on down the road. One of the things the legislature is trying to keep in place is the amount of property taxes that counties collectively can levy, which is $125 million right now. The current fiscal year, I believe the total amount levied is about $118 million, so we're just a little bit under that. But when they look at this per capita formula, the mark they're trying to hit at is $125 million. So your larger counties are going to be primarily the ones getting the state funds or relying on the state for that backfill.
Mm-hmm. Deb, it's a double whammy as I see it, because now, as this bill's currently put forward, it's the larger counties generally that are levying less than the $47, so they're going to be getting state funds. There's also a mechanism to take somebody like Story, who probably is going to qualify to be its own region, if you will, to sit there, and I believe the entire idea was trying to draw counties together. And I think that as this bill currently sits, it's going to be beneficial to the larger counties to pull in and stay solo participants, and the smaller counties are not going to have the funding to do what they need to do, nor are they going to have the resources, which are generally in the larger counties, to be able to go do it.
That's what I'm confuses me. I thought the whole theory behind this change was to level the playing field, so these smaller counties that can't offer the services that the larger counties offer by going into a region will have that opportunity, and now it looks like we'll probably just be back where we were before.
Well, but understand that it was all tied to the funding. They could not fund what they wanted with the region.
Right.
And so therefore they had to kind of come back to an alternative. And so we've still encouraged counties to look out and look at collaboration if they so desire, but they're not necessarily going to be mandated to move in this direction, because there was a big, and I forgot what the exact total was, but the state was looking at having to get back from dollars that were appropriated to counties in order to be able to fund the system, which would have really been a detriment to a county such a story. But yeah, I think it was just that they just couldn't come up with a way to fund what they wanted to see happen.
Well, again, I don't know that this is a long-term solution, so I think once the session draws to an end, whatever bill comes out, I think we have to be prudent in looking at all of our options and looking at what strategy is going to be best for the county on down the road. You know, if the larger counties step out and request those exemptions from DHS, those smaller counties aren't going to have a bigger county to attach to. So you're going to have huge regions. Because you're going to have
all
more of those
small counties.
Yes.
You're going to have a huge regions of all small counties. You're going to have large and I don't believe for a second that this is what we're going to end up seeing. But as it sits right now, you're going to see a bunch of small counties who have to get together and all of a sudden collectively provide things that they have never provided individually. You're going to see the large counties try to pull in and just remain self-contained. I think right now, as this says, it's doing the opposite of what we hoped that these kind of things were going to do. And just, you know, a comment for you guys, I think that here in Story County, we've handled this exactly in the most prudent way possible, which is to strengthen all of our infrastructure in this area, be prepared for whatever the state hands down, and then we need to continue with that. When they come forward, like Deb just said, we need to be one of the counties out front in advocating what's right for Story County based on whatever rules they give us.
Good. Thank you.
Okay.
Anything else?
No,
thank
that's
you.
All I have. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Appreciate it.
Okay, now as you look at the agenda, we're ready to move back up to item number one. Consideration of Resolution 1278 to set April 24, 2012 as a date for a public hearing on the proposed amendment to the county's general obligation county road improvement loan agreement. That information, of course, was contained in the packet. And as my understanding at this point, it's really just discussion regarding setting the date for the public hearing. Is that correct? I see Renee is sitting back there and others, but I believe this has to do with the general obligation road improvement, Darren, and so forth. So really right now it's just a matter of a discussion or comments regarding setting a date. Is that your understanding? Okay. All right. So I guess my question would be, are there any questions for Darren regarding the April 24, 2012 for the date for the public hearing, which has to be set by resolution, I understand. Is that correct? Right. Okay. Hearing that?
Okay. I would move that we, excuse me, approve resolution 1278 and set the date for the public hearing as April 24th, 2012.
Second.
Been moved and second to set the date of April 24th, 2012 by resolution 1278 for the public hearing on the proposed amendment to the county's general obligation county road improvement loan agreement. Any further comments? Hearing none, roll call, Toot.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton. Aye. Resolution 1278 is adopted.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to item number two, the consideration of Resolution 1273, amending the administrative procedure for floodplain management and regulations. Again, Planning and Development Director Leanne.
As Story County participates in the National Flood Insurance Program, not only do you have to adopt a floodplain management ordinance, you're required to have administrative procedures for implementing said ordinance. What's before you is a resolution that amends the administrative procedures that have been adopted for several years to reflect the department name change that went into effect January 1st. So I ask that you approve this, but have it go into effect July 1st, which will allow us time to have the ordinance for the floodplain management and the things adopted and reprinted and have all the pieces and ready to go.
I might say these are the simple type of resolutions when all it is involving a name change.
Okay. I would move approval of resolution 1273.
Second.
Been moved and second to the approval of resolution 1273. Any further comments? Hearing none. Roll call. Toot.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton. Aye. Resolution 1273 is adopted. Shelley, how are you doing? Okay, then moving on to item four under additional items is consideration of grant application for the REACH program from the Byrne JAG grant program at $110,000 with a match of 25% from the commissary fund. John Osmondson from Sheriff's Department and Jail Administrator, take it away.
Oh, you guys got any questions? I've submitted it last week. Everything looks, hopefully we'll get a good shot at it. So.
No, I had just an email, a comment or two from the sheriff and so forth saying that they would be available if we had any additional questions or concern. I've not received any, you know, real issues. Again, for the benefit of the audience, could you explain the commissary fund and how this has arrived? We probably have people here to see that term and may not be familiar with it.
Well, we operate inside the jail. We actually sell commissary items like chips, pop, things like that that we sell to the inmates. And then the profits that we make off those, we put into a fund, the commissary fund, that we can use towards for their betterment. We buy their TVs. That way the taxpayers don't have to buy their TVs. We buy, again, for this, we're looking at using this towards this program to help them deal with their substance abuse. So we want to use the funds rather than use taxpayer money, use the commissary fund to help them give a substance abuse program.
Okay. So it's important for us to understand that this is a grant application right now. There is no guarantee that we will receive it. We're hopeful, based on prior history of success with the Byrne grant JAG program, that we will be awarded that, and so this 25% would be the local match.
Move approval of the match from the commissary fund for the grant application.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded the approval of the funds from the 25% local match from the commissary fund for the grant application. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, John. Okay, item 5 is consideration of Story County flexible benefit plan policy with a 7-day review. HR Director Alyssa, please come on down.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, the policy that you have in front of you doesn't change the amount or anything, the flexible benefit plan. It does make the cash option contingent upon an employee having health insurance. So under our current policy, employees can take their money and apply it towards the health insurance, group plan health insurance, or they can take the cash. And the only change to this is we would require proof of insurance in order for each employee to take the benefit in cash. This came about, there are going to be a lot of changes with health care reform. And there's an employer mandate that says if you have more than 50 employees, you have to provide insurance. If you don't, you'll be fined. I've done a lot of research, talked with a lot of different attorneys, question as to what happens if, you know, since we have this flexible benefit plan, what if our employees don't have insurance? Their recommendation is to make sure they're insured, make the cash benefit contingent upon insurance. We will not, I can't guarantee this, but according to them, we will not be fined if they don't have insurance because the amount that we provide our employees would almost cover a single plan, and that's what they look at. Now, the specific employees that don't have insurance may be fined under the individual mandate, which is actually kind of up in the air right now.
Lisa, and for both the two of you, this has been a topic that I've struggled with for years that I've served on the board. I've always appreciated the fact that we had included in the flexible plan the dollars that was originally put forth to go toward an insurance plan, whether you had the county's plan or your own plan through your spouse or some other private insurer. The idea, again, from my way of looking at this, what we're trying to basically do is maintain a healthy workforce. And if employees have insurance, chances are they're going to go to the doctor more frequently and make sure that they can stay healthy, and therefore we're not going to have loss of work time and productivity because of illnesses or things that basically occur. Now, that's not to say that that's exactly what will happen or not happen, but there seems to be a common factor that if you do have the ability to go to the doctor on a regular basis and it is covered under a health plan, it's more likely you're going to do that than if you don't have it. And I've wondered whether or not we should have had this concern, and the question always at the time of registration is, we have asked employees in the past, are you insured or not? And they basically just could say yes or no, but there have never been any opportunity to determine if they do have a policy. And so I've always been very supportive of us really taking a look at this, and I think it's something that we should do. I don't see this as a penalty in any way, shape, or form. It's just simply saying that from a county's point of view as an employer, we are encouraging all of our employees to have some level of insurance. Not saying that they have to be part of the county insurance plan, but they need to have some level of insurance. So that's kind of the driving force behind the way that I've always viewed this policy, understanding that there can, from time to time, be extenuating circumstances that may come up with individual employees. But it was never my understanding that I wanted to be in a situation where I would say encourage people not to be insured. But that's neither here or there. So, Alyssa, I do appreciate you researching this. I appreciate you bringing this forward. I know this is something we've talked to the county attorney's office over the several years, and there still is some level of discussion regarding the level by which we as an employee can actually require some proof of insurance. It is my belief that this is again is a proper exercise of our responsibility, but there again it's a matter of interpretation.
That's the question that I have, is that are we in the conversations that you've had with different attorneys or even Steve Owen from the county attorney's office, are we within our scope as an employer to request that an employee provide us proof of insurance before they're eligible for this flex benefit?
For the flex benefit, yes. I actually, we had two options when putting this plan together. You can, they won't be eligible if they don't have insurance or wish not to prove that they have insurance, they don't get the cash benefit. Or you could automatically enroll them on your group plan. I did take the route, if they don't want to have insurance, that's their choice. But they will not be eligible for the flexible benefit in cash if they don't have insurance.
I had a couple questions and one thought. I guess one question. Can you or Steve tell me what is the difference between credible medical insurance and not credible medical insurance? I mean, where's that decision made? Where's that distinction? That, as I read through this, that's the one area that I kind of go, okay, tell me, if you're saying this, there's got to be one on either side of the line. Can you tell me what that is?
I could almost answer that, and I'm not even an attorney.
Go ahead. I don't know if I'll be able to answer it any better, but that's a term of art that's typically used in the benefits arena, in the legal arena. It doesn't mean credible as in incredible or not credible. What it means is a legitimate and covered.
Right, but I guess my question is, what level? If I choose to go get a health insurance policy that has a $50,000 deductible, so anything that happens up to $50,000, I'm responsible for on my own. But I get this policy. Does that count as a policy under credible medical insurance?
Policy that can be sold in the state of Iowa is a credible policy.
Okay.
That's it.
That's what it comes down to. If it can be sold in the state of Iowa, recognized as health insurance,
then
we would recognize it as credible health insurance.
That's exactly right.
We have recognized for many years that the level of risk, say a young person who may feel that they are extremely healthy and so forth, may oftentimes opt to a much higher deductible simply because it would be at a lower premium rate. And depending upon just what that difference would be, would make a big difference whether it's $1,000, $5,000, $25,000. In most cases, majority of the people are probably going to be somewhere within that $1,000 to $2,000 range. I don't know very many that's going to go to $10,000 to $15,000 deductible. But you're right, that is a possibility that could exist.
Because as I read this, we don't care what the health insurance is costing an employee who chooses to take the flex benefit. It can cost them more or less than is it $575 right now? That $575. But I guess my other question is, as I viewed the flex benefit from the time I've been sitting out in the audience in 2008 to now, is it was there for employees to purchase health insurance. Is that right or wrong? I mean, if that's what it is,
it's our benefits package.
Otherwise,
we wouldn't, you know, if it was meant to be a salary, it would be included in their salary.
So we've got taxpayer dollars that are going to our employees to purchase health insurance, and we've never been able to look to see whether they have health insurance or not.
Correct.
Okay.
And this is a discussion that I've had many a times in my role as a negotiator for the Sheriff's Office bargaining unit. Every time when contract negotiations would come up, this topic would come up, and everybody at that table knew full well that this benefit plan that the county offered was somewhat unique. and that at any time it's the county's prerogative to switch from the flex cash to a paid single policy for all its employees. And we tried to stress to our members that this is not part of your salary. This is not a bonus. This is not an increase. This is to pay for benefits. If you select to take this money in cash, you get taxed on it. And that's why I think a lot of people think, well, yeah, it is part of my income. And then people build their budget on that additional roughly $7,000 a year. And it's unfortunate that happens, but we could decide tomorrow as a county that we are no longer going to offer the flex cash. We're going to provide all of our employees with a paid single policy, and it would be the same thing.
Right.
So it's going to be a difficult pill to swallow for some of our employees, but it's I think it's all in how you look at what this flex cash was actually intended to be.
And in my research, a lot of these flexible benefit plans were pretty popular 15, 20 years ago. A lot of your employers are phasing them out. I'm not suggesting that that's what the county needs to do, but we do need to put certain things in place to make sure our employees are insured. And that we are doing everything that we can to provide them the means to get insured.
And that's even the last sentence in the paragraph in the union contract, that ultimately it's the employer's decision what to do with the insurance. We can confer with the unions, and you've reached out to the union reps and let them know that this policy change is being contemplated. So. I'm going to move approval of the change in the flex benefit policy pending the, well, it's normally a 7-day review, but we won't meet again until the 24th, so it'll be a 14-day review.
Prior to putting the motion on the floor, I just want to acknowledge that we have received a couple communications from employees just concerning the change, the proposed change. If they wish to speak publicly regarding this, I would certainly give them the opportunity. But to basically say that I believe each of us perhaps have seen that, have given consideration to their comment, and I just want to acknowledge that there will be from time to time circumstances that individuals may or may not have that will cause individuals to question the rationale or the reason why this is in place, but I did not want to dismiss the fact that even though if we do pass this 7-day period, again, will be an extended opportunity for people to give us feedback before a final decision is made to implement this fully. I think the understanding, though, is that at the end of the 7 days with the review, unless there is a reason for us to amend, that it would stand as approved today. Is that your understanding?
Correct. There are. I have had a comment on the subsidized medical insurance. That last paragraph.
Right.
That is if they are receiving their benefits through the government.
Right.
Medicaid is an example. Or, you know, once the exchanges are in place, I don't know when they're actually going to be in place. If they get that insurance through the exchange and the government's paying for their policy, they are not eligible for the flex cash. So we're not going to give them the additional dollars if they are getting their insurance paid for.
They can certainly take that flex money and put it into an annuity account.
Correct.
Or do.
Correct. We have the flexible medical.
Other than take it in their paycheck.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess the other question I wanted to, well, it's not so much as a question, but I almost lost that train of thought. But
then I'll go ahead and second Paul while you're looking for that train.
Okay.
Okay. Over.
We have a motion. Yeah, okay. A second. Sure. We will give you an opportunity. We have a motion and a second. Normally, something like this, there wouldn't be the opportunity, but because we have received questions from members of our staff, our employees, I wanted to give them an opportunity. So please go ahead.
I guess I understand where all this is coming from, and you have seen my
concern. What's your name again? For
Matt Corey with Carmel Health. With the subsidy comment in there, when the state does figure that out, they figure that $6,600 or whatever that is as part of your income, and you are eligible for that subsidized with that extra income, or not income, but with that extra figure provided into that. So I guess even you're making that extra flex benefit into your figure, you're still eligible for the state subsidized, and then they're taking that away, so you would even be more qualified for that state subsidized. And then another concern I have is the administration of the policy. There's no rules. Is it going to be that any of you three or Alyssa can come up to us any time and say, let me see your insurance card? Or is it going to be at the time of open enrollment, you have to provide 12 months of...
I think the thought is for the employee to provide the proof of insurance during the open enrollment period.
That's the way it's been in the past. Technically, in the past, you were asked to sign a statement after you were asked a question. And so, technically, let's assume that if you said, yes, you have insurance, and then we discovered that you didn't have insurance, you have, in essence, been false in your reporting as a condition of your continual employment, the way I would look at it. And we would hope that we wouldn't put employees in a position such as that. So maybe that, again, will need to be some details spelled out as to just what we need. Do we need a policy number, the name? What is the type of information that would need to be there? And then probably a statement, too, that you would sign off on, just like we currently, you know, have in place right now.
And while I can only speak for me, Matt, I feel pretty secure in this statement that there will never be a board of supervisor member that will see anybody's health insurance card.
And I'm not concerned about
it.
That's
an HR issue. Yep. I view it as a once-a-year kind of HR issue, like you said, in the open enrollment period. I think that's what you had in mind in this policy. You know, just living up to our responsibility to the people of Story County that when we approve money to pay for something, that's actually what it's going toward. But, for me, that's what it comes down to.
And like I stated in my email to you guys, that I choose, because I rarely go to the doctor, that I choose to put that money aside and pay outright for the doctor visit instead of spending X amount of dollars. I to me, that feels more of a waste, and that's the way that I choose to use that benefit.
Sure,
is to set it aside and pay outright.
Matt, I appreciated your email, and that was what led me to the question I had of what is a credible medical insurance policy, because it seems to me that an individual should have the option that if they want to pay for their routine doctor visits and everything else, great. The problem comes down to you're going to be limited on the level that you can go to. And, you know, God forbid something bad happen and you end up in a serious, serious condition. No matter how good a job you're doing putting money away to cover it, you won't be able to.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that, and absolutely, I take that risk. And
well, but you don't take that risk completely. We all take that risk. And all I'm saying is, and this is my belief and my belief only, that if the county is using taxpayer dollars for our employees to have that health insurance, that insurance option, insurance against one of those major catastrophic events, that it's reasonable to expect that you actually have that. And if you don't want to do it, hey, I support your right to make your own decisions, but then the county shouldn't be using tax dollars for that option. And again, I'm speaking just for me. That's the way I view it, Matt.
And I understand that, and yeah.
Yep.
And then the other policies that are in the consent agenda, are those written out because they weren't in the documentation?
They'll be addressed. All it basically is a compliance with some of the new regulations and so forth that are there. It's really not a major change. It's just that we've not had a policy which clearly addressed it, that as part of the cleanup process. Right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So we have a motion and a second to approve the flexible benefit plan and issue it to the employees for the 7-day review period. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Alyssa, thanks for your work on this.
Okay. Alyssa, while you're there, since this is on the consent agenda, and rather than having to pull that, the question did come up, would you perhaps just comment just briefly on the two considerations that is listed here regarding, I believe it's item 9 and item 10 in the consent agenda. It's consideration of adopting the amendment, the restated flexible benefit plan, and the amended restated dependent care assistance plan.
These plan documents were actually submitted to Davis Brown Law Firm to update and get in compliance with IRS regulations. Since they are part of a 125 cafeteria plan, the IRS does audit those once in a while. We had not updated our plans to include the Family Medical Leave Act, the language that needs to be in there. Leave of absences were not covered in these plan documents. It's all regulated information. We didn't change the plans at all. We did mid-year events. Those regulations per IRS have changed over the years, and we just updated our policy or our plan documents to include those. We will have a couple more than what we currently have. Dependent care is one of them. If your dependent care provider changes for decides not to do it anymore, you find a new one and you need to either increase your amount that's going towards dependent care reimbursement or decrease it. Our employees will be able to do that now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the comment. Okay. Okay, then, referring back to the agenda then, we're down to item 6, discussion and consideration of the FY13 Iowa DOT secondary five-year road plan. Welcome back, Darren.
It's been a long time getting here, Darren. Feels like we've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
Okay.
A second while this warms up, but I did pass out some updated slides in the blue.
Right. And Darren, I'll ask this question so that you might even comment on it. I think you indicated last week that there is an amendment process. Because of the timing of this plan that has to be submitted to the DOT, even if approved as it's laid out right now, we could come back and amend that plan or some of the projects and things of that nature at a later time. Is that correct?
Correct, and some of that depends on each project and the funding that goes along with it. Sometimes they don't even need to be in the program, so we can cover that at the end,
okay.
Which is which. Okay, let's start. I edited these slides a little bit. I wanted to cover them quickly. The Mark Farland Park Road, you approved that resolution earlier to set the hearing date for the 24th to do that, and the actual letting for the project is on April 24th, too, so we are, looks like we're going to be able to get that done by the end of the year, so we're able to stretch those bond money out a little bit and get one extra project done, so that'll be nice. TIF, I didn't change anything there. The last blue dot there, history of 600, that came up at last board meeting, so I wanted to give you some of the history of paving projects in our program. This project was added in 2006 for paving grade. It was removed the next year in 2007 due to funding constraints. I pulled out one of our previous programs here, 01 to 05 program, just to give you an idea. This had three more grade and pave projects on it, 170th that Gilbert wrote out to the ISU Horticultural Farm, South Elwood, which is now South University, and South S Avenue, South and Nevada. Those are all grade and pave projects that were in the program that also got pulled, all due to funding, just didn't have the money to pave roads anymore. So just want to give a little history that that does happen. Projects get pulled out for funding reasons. New grade and pave projects, the process for that, discussion and decisions should ideally, in my opinion, be part of the five-year program process. That's what it's there for. So we look at the entire, our road system as a whole. We could possibly hold more of a workshop-type meeting. We've done this in the past to allow for more of a detailed discussion on these projects and kind of set priorities. What's our highest priority for paving or bridges? That's something I'd probably recommend in the future to think about. And these meetings would still be open to the public. We must approve the five-year program today to meet our DOT deadline, so that needs to be done at the end of our discussion here. And any of these additional paving projects we're talking about, due to the time frames that I'll discuss on the next slide, I'd like to have a decision on that by July 1st so we know how to proceed. And that's due to this development time frame we have. If we decide to do one of those grade and pave projects, the earliest we could get to the project survey would be this fall with the staff we have available. We'd then be able to start design and plan work this winter, next winter, and then right-of-way acquisition and appraisals would be during the spring of 2013. Assuming all that goes well, we could have a letting. One of the projects required DOT letting, and one of them went, depending on the funding type, but the DOT requires a 3-month lag there between right-of-way and letting. So that would put the letting at the summer of 2013, and then possible fall construction at the very earliest for either one of these projects.
Darren, what's the difference in requiring the DOT letting process and not?
For instance, if we decide to use farm market money on that, that would require a DOT letting.
So it's all a funding mechanism.
It's all due to what type of funding you use, yeah. You requested I update on our dust control policy that we currently use. Currently, private landowners obtain a permit through approved vendors. So they send their permit to, we have 3 approved vendors. That's all shown on our website. These vendors then collect all the applications and submit them to us at once. And we come up with a time each year that they come into the county to spray everything at a reduced cost because they can come and do them all at once. We also have to prepare the roads before the dust control comes in, so we have an organized process to get that done efficiently. The current cost is right around $400 for the private landowner. They can apply privately, do it on their own, buy the materials and apply it on their own. We do require permits so we can prepare the road, but we do allow that. Story County has paid for dust control under special circumstances. We have one going on right now, E18. We have closed for that bridge replacement, so a lot of that traffic is taken a mile north and a mile south, so we did do some dust control just in front of the houses there, which is common for detours for construction. That'll just be a one application in the spring. And we do dust control. It's just one house. It's actually in Boone County because that's where our gravel stockpile it is for, but when the county's hauling with county trucks, we dust control in front of that one house. But those are really the instances of us applying dust control and paying for it ourselves. Recycled asphalt millings. We've tried this in 2 spots recently. One was on 600th Avenue. That was 09, I believe. We actually put 300 tons down on that, about a half mile stretch. We get these from Manats, and it depends on if they're available or not, and they do have some currently at $11 a ton, and the rock is, our current rock price at Martin Marietta is $8.50 a ton, so to give you the cost difference there. The other instance where we used it was on it was a public road, but it's a dead-end road, a bunch of houses at the back. They requested, when it was time for our normal rock application, could they pay the difference and switch that to millings, and so we agreed to do that, and they paid the difference between rock and what the millings cost. Getting into the 2 projects, the first one is paving 600th or 590th Avenue between Highway 30 and Lincoln Way. Some of the options we've talked about, the obvious one is continue as a gravel road. Currently gets 130 vehicles per day. That's 600th Avenue. I think 590th gets a little less than that. And then you'd continue, property owners would follow the current dust control policy we have in place now. Second option would be for the county to fund some dust control. Give you some of the costs for that dust control. Each of those is to do the entire mile, just so we had an apples-to-apples comparison, but we would probably just do in front of the houses would be my guess, and that'd be $400 per house. But to compare the millings price to the chloride, the millings would be a little bit cheaper, but they're not as effective.
And so that I'm clear, are the millings instead of gravel, or are they in addition to gravel?
When we've done it in the past, we've done it instead, not in addition.
And how often do we put gravel down on a road like 600th?
Every 2 to 3 years.
And when was the last time we put it down there?
I believe that was the 09.
So it's due for gravel again.
It is. We are in the process of hauling to that section right now. We've kind of held off on 600. We're hauling limestone, which is more dusty, so we've held off on 600. We might, depending on what we do here, we might haul gravel there instead because it's a little less dusty if we don't do anything else.
But what I'm getting to is if we're already planning on hauling gravel at $8.50 a ton, it's the same, 300 tons to do that whole mile, or we could do the asphalt millings, which are available for $11 a ton. You're talking about, quick math, $2.50 per ton, 300 tons. I mean, you're talking about, $800 difference if it's due for gravel now. Help me, am I seeing all that accurately?
That's accurate. The millings probably doesn't have quite as much rock in it as what we'd get if we put a rock application on. It has a lot more fine material, but it does an okay job for a while, but it doesn't last real long, and a dust suppressant. So
it's a temporary solution.
Temporary solution. And if we did go that route, I think you'd need to justify why you're doing it on this one road and consider a policy change to our dust control policy. Last option is to pave the road. Possible funds we could use, estimated cost $950,000. DIF money, foreign to market, which would require the FM map change, which discussing it with the committee, I think we could get that done for probably either one, 600th or 590th, due to the ethanol plant. And then the last option would be general fund. Secondary road funds just isn't an option. We don't have that amount of money available in a given year.
And let me ask this question, and maybe it's good that Lisa's here. We don't have that money available on a given year based on levying 75% of the allowable dollars for road use.
Correct.
If we were to levy the full allowable amount, then that's an extra $500,000 a year?
I believe it was in the area of $400,000, and then you do have to take into account the Farm Bureau lawsuit on how that affects our maxes levies. That's a question for the county attorney on if we can actually reach that amount. But
we can't. Would you repeat that, and just in case we weren't able to pick her up on the audio? I think it's an important message. Can you do that, Darren?
Yeah, Lisa commented that I don't know what the limit would be, but we are limited below what our normal limit would be due to property tax reduction portion of the
right.
We had a portion that was general county betterment and a portion that was property tax reduction, so there's a portion that would be limited, but I don't know what that dollar amount would be.
Now, before you go on, let me just back you up just a moment, and just from a practical point of view, you said we may need to reconsider the dust control policy if we would decide to do something for this one particular road. The problem, though, for this particular road, though, has a lot to do with the hauling to the new ethanol plant that has been constructed there, which has increased that traffic over time, and we're talking about hauling of heavy truckloads and so forth. So it's not the normal type of travel that one might expect with, you know, cars and so forth. So it's really heavy industrialized traffic. So to me, the rationale would be an easier explanation than it would be on a typical any other road. But as you're saying, we would have to still have a good reason if we would change that.
Yeah, I looked at, this is getting a little dated, but it's still, there wasn't a lot of changes on traffic counts on our gravel roads. If you want to, we took traffic counts last fall on our own on 600, and it was 130 vehicles a day. DOT's counts show 110. We could go out there when we see a lot more activity to try to get, when we get the week or two flurry out there, more trucks to see what that actually is. But if you look at some of our other gravel roads to give you a good comparison, over 100 vehicles a day, looks like there's about 70 miles we have of that. Looks like we have about 20 that gets over 200 vehicles a day. Just to kind of give you on the number of roads we have.
Darren, help me understand, is a vehicle a vehicle a vehicle, or does it matter what kind of vehicle? I mean, if I have 118-wheelers coming down my road every day on gravel, or there's 200 cars, how do those equate? I mean, do we have any idea how those two equate? Are they the same as 100 big semis the same as 100 cars?
I wouldn't know how to equate it. I would say a semi is going to create more dust. It says that the more length, it kind of sucks it underneath that semi, and I would say it would create more, but I don't know how, way of quantifying that.
I think that's what we have to be careful when we start to consider changing our dust control policy. I mean, I talked to you yesterday about a gentleman that had called me. He lives on 19th Street south of the hospital. That road's got 340 cars a day on it.
Yep.
So, I mean, where do we draw the line? I mean, everybody that lives on a gravel road in Story County wants that road paved. I've lived on a gravel road my entire life, and it's a fact. It's just a fact of life. If you choose to live in rural Story County on a gravel road, you have to know that you're going to have to put up with dust. And, you know, we can talk about paving 590th, or we can talk about paving 600th. I think a lot of that depends on what happens with the when the new cellulosic ethanol plant goes in. You know, does the city of Nevada extend the frontage road all the way across from where the current ethanol plant is now? Is it going to go clear down and join up with 590th? I mean, I think a lot of the reason that they come up 600th right now is because it's too difficult for them to turn from Airport Road onto Lincoln Way, because you've got the hill with the traffic coming down over the top of the bridge. It's a straight shot to go up 600th, cross Lincoln Way, and get on the frontage road to go into the ethanol plant. Those semis, if they come from the west, cannot turn into the ethanol plant where the office is. They have to come all the way down to 600th to get in and make access on the access road.
Correct.
City doesn't extend that access road all the way to 590th, you're still going to have the problem with semis that are going to come down to access the road. They're going to come up 600th. And I think it all goes back to, on the second page, we need to sit down and determine if we're going to put our priority on paving roads or we're going to put our priority on fixing bridges. And that's, I don't know how we're going to be able to possibly do both of them unless the outlook changes drastically. I mean, that bridge list that you gave us 2 weeks ago had two bridges on there that are going to cost over $1 million a piece to replace.
Yep.
And the question we have to answer, do we seriously think about replacing those bridges, or do we close them?
Yeah, somebody mentioned earlier wants have turned into needs. I would agree. That list of projects I gave you, those have really turned into needs and not so much wants anymore. And we can't fund them all, so we're going to have to – it's going to be tough to pick which is our priority, but we have to start picking.
But I would just say that's why the three of us sit here. You know, we all made the decision to run for this office, and there's tough decisions, and there's decisions that make some people happy and some people mad, and we just do it. But, Paul, I'd go back. You said something that really resonates with me, but I just want to ask your opinion on something. When you choose to live out in the county, as you do on a gravel road, you accept, you know, the dust and the things that are, you know, the rougher ride and everything else. My question to you is, you've been out there 20 years now or so, your whole life, but where you are now. So you went in there with an expectation of what it was going to be. What if something happens just down the road from you where all of a sudden you start getting all kinds of 18-wheeler traffic that you haven't gotten, And that changes dramatically. They put something down from you on Lincoln Way at the end of your road where trucks start deciding to cut through from Highway 30. Would that change the way you felt about it? Or would that be, well, I just decided to live out here and that's the way it is?
Well, I think you'd have to think about both of them. It wouldn't be any different than if my neighbor down the road decides to put up a hog confinement.
Right.
I'm grateful that he hasn't. He raises a lot of cattle and he's been cleaning the lot this last 2 weeks, and that's not the most pleasant experience. I guarantee you. So it's
right.
But I mean, it's a fact of life. It's unfortunate that you know, for Nancy, that the ethanol plant went up where it went, and the semis choose to go up her gravel road. But it comes back to priorities. Is it that important that we pave that road so that to control the dust, or is it more important that we look at a bridge that needs to be replaced? That's going to cost about the same amount of money as it would to pave that gravel road. That's what I have to look at.
Well, the impetus behind this project is dust, and the next project is Grant. The impetus there is safety. So we have kind of two different issues here. Grant, a lot of the same options are available here. Continuous gravel road, that gets 210 vehicles a day. That's actually went down from in the past. So our new counts are to come out this summer, so I'd be interested to see what those new counts are. I would think they would go up, and with the new school, I would expect them to go up also. County to fund dust control, same options. Not a lot of houses on that road yet, so it'd be more like safety, maybe intersection or something, but we did put the stop signs out there, which will help that. Impose a lower speed limit. This is something that was already done on 600 to try to control the dust. This would be more for safety concerns because you look at the crash data and they're almost all speed related and out of control driving. So how do you fix that? Speed is about the only thing I can think of other than paving the road so you won't have the loose gravel. But when we do get together with that committee within Trans, is the next item on here, we're going to discuss those options with the sheriff and see what recommendations they have. And like I mentioned, one of them was going to be the stop signs, but we already put those in place.
And that's just a two-way stop now, or is that a four-way?
It's just a two-way, so that could be an additional thing to put a four-way there. But speed's a difficult thing. The way counties do speed, it's based on a speed study and does an 85th percentile, and that's how you set speeds out in the county. It's different than how they do it in town. This may be a unique enough circumstance where we could adjust that because we have the crash data to show there's so many high-speed, reckless driving-type crashes out there. Maybe another reason, but normally the county wouldn't set a speed limit for that purpose. And the last option, of course, pave the road, possible funds, TIF, and general fund, which probably doesn't have the money either right now, but... So really, I'm looking at TIF as the main option there. Don't see this as a possibility of adding a farm to market. That group would not approve this as a farm to market road with a pay mile each way. And
not a farm to market road.
No, it's not.
I mean, it's just not. The difference for me in this one is, you know, looking at the county maps and where every one of our high schools in the county are situated, there is no other gravel road anywhere in the county that's going to deal with this level of young people driving on and on a daily basis once that high school gets open. I mean, you look at how many Gilbert students come out of the Bloomington Heights, Northridge Heights area, and now with the high school moving south of town on that road, I mean, that is going to be the natural straight shot through. And so I just, you know, rightly or wrongly, I view this one a little differently. And maybe it's because I've got three, you know, one that's just out of high school, one that's graduating, and one that's in high school. And we're going to have a lot of kids on, I would say, regardless of what your vehicle count, we're going to have more kids on this road than any other gravel road in the county, not even close. And so for me, and Paul, I think you're 100% right. I think it is about priorities. We can't do everything, and we're going to have to make choices here and there. But this one, for me, takes on a little more emotional pull simply because who's going to be on it every single day?
You are absolutely right. And what I'm struggling with is that you look at the map, and first of all, young, inexperienced drivers don't belong on a gravel road. That's something that the driver's head system sorely misses, is to have kids go out and drive on a gravel road, because I can't tell you the number of accidents that I covered in 30 years at the sheriff's office when a kid was driving down a gravel road too fast, hit a washboard or whatever, got too close to a wet shoulder, and now he's on his top in the ditch. But you look at the map, and if you don't want to drive that gravel road to Gilbert, you go a mile in either direction, and you can take a paved road to Gilbert. Absolutely no questions about it. And it's a matter of choices. If you don't want your son or daughter driving to school in Gilbert, go to that new school up that gravel road, you say, you've got your choice. You can go left or you can go right. You can go George Washington Carver, or you can go up 69 to maintain that safe drive on a paved road. The other question is, the worst part of that gravel road is south of 190, and the city's got no plans to do anything with that. I mean, as far as a gravel road goes, you go north of 190th up to Gilbert, that's probably a pretty decent stretch of gravel. It's wide, it's flat. We've got controlled intersections on the way up, but if you go south of there, it's hilly. It gets narrow at the bottom of that hill where the bridge is. That's the absolute worst section of road, and that's the section that the city of Ames has no intent on doing anything with. So, and that is absolutely what I struggle with, is that if you don't want your son or daughter driving to school on that gravel road, then tell them don't drive to school on that gravel road. I mean, it's going to happen whether mom and dad tell them not to or not. But they have an alternate safe route to school. And I look where that new school is going. It's two blocks south of where the old one is. And they're still going to use the same park. You know, the parking lot's still on the east and the west side of the school. You know, they're not coming up that gravel road in mass now to get to school. But, I mean, they will if you change the location. But it's still, they've got that option. They've got the option to go up Highway 69 or go up George Washington Carver.
Well, Paul, I'm not going to disagree with your comment nor Supervisor Sanders' comment. I think, though, that when we look at the rationale for why do we pave any of our roads when we're talking about going from gravel to pavement, there are factors that enter into that equation. And if the factors are substantial because of increased usage of that road, traffic counts, and things of this nature, regardless to whether it's youth or adults, it just so happened in this case that it is going to probably be used more by the students. But I could also envision when school activities are going on that people who are going to go to those activities may use this as a straight shot as well. So what I look at is does the conditions exist that would cause us to look at the rationale as to why we would pave a given road? And if it does, then the question becomes, what is the timetable for doing that? Looking at the funds available, if you've got five or six projects that you've placed in your five-year plan, but circumstances and factors have now changed that says that this one is probably going to be generating a higher level of traffic in a shorter span of time, the question should be, is should our priorities somewhat change in terms of directing resources to deal with that at that point in time? And right now, for me, more than anything, it's trying to figure out a way to fund it, to come up with the dollars. I believe the priorities and the rationale for doing it is certainly there. But do we have the capacity to do so now? And if not this year, what is the capacity through the next year? You mentioned TIF funds. Right now, TIF dollars that we are currently using are already dedicated towards certain projects. Now, we originally looked at a dollar figure that we didn't use the maximum amount for that. So, therefore, in terms of the actual dollars used, we are only utilizing dollars based on the actual cost of the projects that are in place. Would we have to reconsider extending that amount if there were some additional dollars? Because it wasn't at $500,000 was the original area, and we're talking, what, in the neighborhood of
I'll jump in there. The original TIF projects that we put together, I want to say Dakin's Lake is somewhere in the $2.5 million. Is that right? About $2.5 million range. The paving project on 590th is $250,000. And we've approved the idea of $100,000 toward the bike path south. So you add all those up, I mean, you end up, what, close to $3 million in approved TIF projects. Just $500,000 of that is in this year, which I think is a conversation we're going to have later. But this would all be, if you decided to do something like this using TIF funds, we would have to go through the process again of adding this as an acceptable expenditure for those already existing urban renewal districts. Is that right, Stephen? Okay.
Hey, so that's my understanding.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
But I mean that's a factor if we were looking for the possibility of additional funds if there was no other source.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that is a conversation. Once we determine there's limited amount of dollars, no matter how you slice it, there's X number of dollars. Paul has hit the nail on the head when he said we've got to prioritize. We can't do everything. So what are our priorities? We've got to get to the end of that. What are our priorities? And then we've got to figure out how to fund them. And TIF may very well be part of that equation in funding those things, but until we determine how we're setting our priorities and ultimately what that is so that we can direct Darren, you know, this is what we're going to do. Now let's figure out how we're going to pay for it. That's where we got to be. Now, TIF could be part of that, but that would be an interesting conversation of is that an appropriate use for those dollars. Darren, what I want to know is, in the five-year plan, remind me, is there any other new paving projects that we have on the five-year plan right now?
No, just the Vetter.
Just the Vetter as part of that TIF project. In your mind, new paving projects, is there anything in the county that ranks ahead of these? I've heard you mention, you know, going south to the horse farm and a few like that. Is there anything that would rank ahead of these two in terms of new paving?
There's different categories. That's what makes it difficult. This one's safety. The other ones I'm talking about they're hard roads to maintain. 700 vehicles a day out to the Hort Farm, that's a hard road to maintain. You get over 400, it's very difficult to maintain it, so it's constantly full of potholes. And the other one is Elwood. That one has a number of houses on the first mile, and it gets very dusty, so you can probably throw safety into the category on that one, too. So those are the two main ones because of the high traffic counts. So they rank right up here with this, if not higher.
Well, let me just throw out, Board, just for a comfort level, knowing that we can amend or adjust this at a later time, if we're not comfortable today to make a determination of including either one or both of these in place of something that is already on the plan, I would think we would go ahead and approve the plan as submitted, knowing full well that we will be needing to come back and revisit this to see if we want to make an amendment at a later time. But because of the timetable to get this done, as Darren kind of indicated here, he would like to know at least by July 1st what our direction would be because of the letting and everything else that has to go into place in order to get a project done, even in FY13. I would suggest that we consider moving in that direction if that would be the wish of the board so that we still can move forward knowing full well we don't have the answers right now and the prioritization to determine do we want to insert one or both of these in place of what we already have.
Well, and I think I agree with you, but I come to a different conclusion. And so what I would ask is, does this board right now have the ability, if we so chose,
to add these two projects non-date specific. Tell me about those non-date specific items that you have on there and how they work, the ones that don't have a completion date or even a starting date tied to them. What would happen if we chose to do that? Would they have to replace something? Could they be in addition to? It's really important to me that, okay, we've got all the bridges on the list. It's important to me to keep these items officially on our list for dealing with. And Wayne, I think I agree with you. I mean, we've got to have some hard conversations that aren't going to happen this morning, but we got to keep this in front of us. We got to keep pushing ahead. And finally, Paul, get to those hard decisions of what our priorities are going to be. And I think, like you said, by that, is it June 1st or July 1st that Darren's asked for, we got to make some decisions to have these done in a timely fashion. So, Darren, talk to me a little about, if this board chose to add them non-date specific, what would happen?
This is the form. This isn't the program. So the ones that do not have dates on the far left column, they are not in the five-year program. That's the draft I gave to you. So only the ones with the dates, you could add it in the program. The program is supposed to be realistic funding-wise. So there's two different classes here. If we did 600 or 500, we'd put it in as a farm-to-market project now. The other one you could put in as a special money type situation, so you wouldn't have to designate, so the DOT wouldn't say, hey, you don't have this much money. But if you, there's a special category we could put it in. So they could both be added.
They could both be added. We wouldn't have to take anything off, and we wouldn't be committing to that final decision of what our priorities are in terms of those dollars.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
That would be my suggestion that we do here today. We haven't gotten to the bottom of this. We're not going to get to the bottom of it today, but we need to set a pretty hard timeline for ourselves for making a decision on both of these things as it relates to the bridges and everything else we've got to do. And I think this is the first step on keeping it as that priority. So I would make the motion that we add these two non-date specific to the program.
I don't mean to confuse it more, but the TIF, I don't know if you see any other options other than TIF for grant. I really don't.
I don't either.
But if we're only using TIF, that doesn't even have to be in the five-year program, because
right,
that doesn't even come through the secondary road fund.
Right.
But does it affect anything if we put it on the program with the designation of special funds, just so it's on our list? Does it negatively impact anything?
It doesn't, and I would probably actually prefer it that way. So we're looking at everything on the same.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm just
exactly
trying to keep everything above board and put it all out there.
I think it's a good suggestion. I hadn't thought of it. I think it's certainly accomplish exactly what I'm still hoping that we'll be able to deal with at a later time. And so it just puts us right out there in front of us that this is two projects worthy of further deliberation.
I'll second that. Yeah, I want to add both. And for me, it would be 600/590th as a farm-to-market, non-date specific. And I want to add what I consider to be 530th north of 190th. Yep. Sorry.
It does have to be put in a year. So which year do you want me to put them both in? Usually projects enter in the fifth year, 2017, and move their way
does
up.
Does it encumber us at all if we put it in the fifth year, if in our conversations we decide to move things up?
No. The only thing you can't do is put it in the first year, because that's actually what you're going to do. So you can put it in any other.
But this doesn't stop us from doing it if we can locate the funding and decide that it's our priority. And
you can move.
I know
it.
That's a long shot. That's unrealistic.
But I do need to put it under a certain category.
Okay. So then I would amend my motion to say, and put them both in and fifth year out as a placeholder, and list 590th/600th as a possible farm to market paving, and list 530th as a special funding. I'll second your amendment.
It's been moved at second to accept the recommendation of Supervisor Sanders, and I won't try to repeat it. I think it's clearly understood. You got it down, Shelley? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries.
And then a couple more things I want to talk about real quickly with Darren, and Mr. Chair, you're just going to have to stop me if it's inappropriate. Can this board direct, if we so choose, that due to
clearly increased truck traffic, that the next time 600th is due for a gravel overlay, that instead of using gravel, we use the asphalt millings. Is that something we can do and that would be appropriate for the board to take up at this time, or does it need to be its own agenda item?
I don't know, but I think, again, it's a request of I don't know if we've ever necessarily spelled out the different types of what we put down. Is that?
Oh, and I can tell you it's been done in the past, the ones right. In, what, 2009,
right.
By direction from the board.
Just by direction.
So then I would move that we direct our county engineer that the next time that 600th is slated for gravel, that instead of gravel, we use the asphalt millings, understanding that it's going to cost us several $100 additional to do it that way.
Yeah, I have no quick clarification. I don't think it requires a motion. It's not an action item.
Well, but I want to make sure. I mean, he doesn't need to do it if we don't agree to this.
No, but I think what we're saying that it's not an. We're adding. I don't know. Where's the county attorney? Is he still here? We need a little direction here. I'm concerned.
I'll tell you where I'm going to come down on this.
By support here, we can direct him to move forward with that without.
I would say is, you know, the entire discussion of the DOT's planning, especially in that particular area, I think, you know, we've had talks with the district engineers about that area, and I think that's what we're talking
about.
You know, I think we've had discussions with the district engineers about the area between Ames and Nevada. We're talking now about a Department of Transportation Secretary Road 5-year plan. I don't know that you can separate any of this. I think that it encompasses what we're talking about in the agenda item. Any discussion of roads or secondary roads, I think, is a countywide discussion matter, so I don't think it violates any sort of open meeting.
Okay. So appropriate for me to make the motion and then just see where it goes.
I think so.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's what I need to hear. So we have a motion and a second to...
Well, he didn't second it.
I'll second.
I'm sorry. I thought he did. I'm sorry.
Okay. I want to give you the full chance.
I didn't put words in there.
Yeah, I know you didn't.
Okay. And so basically it is to direct Darren that as he finds a time where this is due for gravel overlay or whatever, that he would replace this with the millage.
My understanding that the millage costs $11 per ton as opposed to the $8.50 per ton for the gravel. I'm suggesting that the county absorb that cost. No, as we recognize that there is greatly increased truck traffic on that road, I think this board has the ability to look past policy when warranted, and that's what I'm suggesting we do.
The question I have is then what's going to be our trigger? Because if you do that, my phone's going to ring, and I've got a guy out here on 19th Street that's got 340 cars a day on his mile, and...
I did check, and he does pay for dust control.
He does pay for dust control. But
we've got
100
a very
semis, is that, 340 cars, is that the same as 100 semis?
Well, that's, yeah.
I think it's pretty subjective, and I think it's a really slippery slope if the county decides we're going to start paying for the additional costs for asphalt millings. Granted, it's only if it's $800 for the whole mile, but what's our tipping point? When do we decide that that's what we're going to do?
And what I'm suggesting, Paul, is that we're the tipping point. Anybody who ever wants to request something like this can come to us and request it. And I understand I may be opening a door that I wish I didn't open, but that's where I think the three of us are. I firmly believe, you know, every time I drive by 600th, I take a look, and I firmly believe that it's getting a lot more truck traffic than it was ever intended to get. I believe that truck traffic ranks exponentially higher than auto traffic, and I think it's reasonable while we have the conversation of what we're going to do, if anything, that we pay the additional to put down the asphalt millings, because at least at some level it makes a little bit of a difference. And so that's my rationale behind all of it. Again, understanding that I may be opening a door, but I think anybody is empowered to come ask us any time to do something with their road.
Could you clarify for my purposes, last time we did it, we just did it in front of the houses. Do you want us to do the entire mile or just in front of that first half mile, I think is what we did last time?
Yeah, I'm suggesting that just when you're going out to do, just for simplicity, when you're going out to do that road next time, you replace the gravel with the asphalt millings and let's put it down this time.
It'll give us an opportunity to look at the longevity of this and how it holds up with that increased truck traffic and so forth. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Pose.
Aye.
Okay. Okay. Motion passes. Thank you, Paul. Okay.
Wayne, I'm going to have to get an amended program to,
right,
to sign. I'll get that to you today.
Okay, great. Okay, great.
Darren, thanks for all
and
your work.
Thank
on
you. While Brett is coming up next, agency report, Veterans Affairs, I'm going to take a short. Oh, yes, yes. Well, quarterly report from Lisa.
Before we lose Darren, Wayne, and before you walk out, Darren, can you please make sure that by the end of April you get back with us to continue this conversation? I'm just afraid that if we don't keep it in front of this board, that all of a sudden we're going to look up and it's going to be the middle of June. So sometime in April, so it'd be the 24th or the do we have 30th, or I guess that 24th is the only meeting we have left. I'm not doing my calendar math very well.
I think so, yeah.
Either 24th or May 1st.
I'll be here the 24th for the letting, so.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Thanks, Darren.
Thank you, Darren. Good job. Hey.
Or without him.
Okay. Thank you.
So she can get out of here.
For letting me move up. I need to head to Waterloo. So you have the quarterly financial report in front of you. The highlighted departments, which I hope came through, have been 100% appropriated. I'll cover that quick. It's General, County Betterment, Engineer, Veterans Affairs, IRVM, CLP, Mental Health, and Countywide Services. So in our processes of appropriations this year, we've appropriated those 100%. There are three departments that are over 75% of the year. Animal Control, Community Services, and Mental Health. Overall, we are 5.63% under budget on our expenditures. Fund balances, the general supplemental together is running about a 1.5% below budgeted. The Mental Health Fund is about 5% above budgeted percent for where we're at in the year. For revenues, overall, we have 11 departments that are over 75% of the year, which I like that. And overall, it's 10.69% above the budgeted revenues. So we're ahead of revenues. Now, understand that March is when the other half of property tax receipts come in. We'll still see some more in April, but that kind of pushes us up a little for where we're at in the year. At this time, aside from the departments that were highlighted in this report, there's still 5% remaining for appropriation. I have not gotten a direction from the board as to when and if we're going to appropriate those dollars. I did do some calculations to help you along in that decision. With the current balance, we have in all of our funds right now, the expected remaining revenues, the appropriated expenses. I have a fund balance projection for the general fund at about 25%. Okay? The calculations that I have made regarding the dollars that won't be spent leaves about $180,000 in the general fund that we were not anticipating. Last time we amended the budget, we anticipated the ending fund balance of the general fund to be about 21%, so we're up a little. Obviously, the revenues are up a little. That helps. It has not been a hard winter. That helps. The salary line items, in my opinion, should be appropriated. So the remaining salary line item should be appropriated. Some of the departments do need that. Some of them don't need it, according to my calculations, because of vacancies, because of just whatever situation has arisen throughout the year. They would not have to have those dollars to make payroll for the rest of the year. I have started doing those calculations on a monthly or on a weekly, biweekly basis as to where we're at on salaries. For the mental health fund, with the projections I have, the cash ending fund balance looks to be about 8.6%. That means the accrual would be close to 2.5%. Some of the amounts that we've talked about this, some of the amounts that we're saving in CLP salaries that they're not going to spend, I'm going to move over to mental health and appropriate it in that department. That's where I'm at. that's where I'm at on everything. Now, I'm really glad to hear that the ending fund balance is not going to be possibly, will not be part of the consideration when it comes to mental health funding, because I have stated all along it's not fiscally responsible for us to get that balance down so low that we can't afford to fund services for the next month. So I never thought it should have been part of the picture. That's my opinion, for what it's worth.
Yeah, don't count on that it's going to stay there.
I know, but I'm just saying, that's my opinion for what it's worth.
Is there any area, department, office, otherwise, that is in desperate need of an appropriation at this point? Or is there the possibility, with all apologies to you of asking you to come back, that we have you come back 1st of May with hard recommendations of what's needed? Because I can't see a reason for us to appropriate dollars at this point in the year that are not absolutely needed.
I have two departments, attorney and, hold on a second, attorney and animal control that need the rest of their dollars appropriated.
Now,
according to my calculations of salary. And, yes, I would gladly come back. I would rather wait a little longer to make the determination, A, whether we're going to need some budget amendments, and, B, whether we're going to need some what the needs are for dollar appropriation.
County attorney and animal control, do they need those dollars between now and May 1st, or are they okay waiting until May
1st? No, they're okay waiting.
My suggestion is going to be that we ask Lisa to come back to us on May 1st with as good of calculations as you can do, which I know will be outstanding as to what we're really going to need the rest of the year, and then we have the conversation about what we're appropriating for the rest of the year. There's two times, guys, that I see it that we really have the opportunity to impact what goes on here in Story County. One is in the budgeting process, and the second one is in the final appropriations. And I just think we need to make sure that we have all the I's dotted and the T's crossed before we make that final decision. It looks like we're doing great, but we could, depending on what happens here the last couple months, is what's going to determine what that is.
Well, I think one of the things that I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think one of the things that we also need to factor in is when departments and elected offices put their budget together and we approve that budget, at our budget hearing and so forth, they are anticipating that those funds would be available. And so some purchases are delayed or not purchased until the last possible moment, depending upon what dollars are appropriated. We know that if they haven't been appropriated to them, they can't spend it. But they understood that those dollars would be available within this calendar year. So if for some reason we are not going to appropriate those, I would like to have that conversation with those departments regarding the urgency of the need for those additional dollars. In the past, we had departments that would turn back certain number of dollars to us that would ultimately go back into the general fund. And that was a good thing to a degree, because they didn't have to spend all those dollars. And we tried to get our expenditures and revenues as based on as close to what we thought needs were, knowing full well that we might have missed here or there. So I just think that as we arrive at that, if we go forward with this, let's make sure we have that conversation so that we understand if there are any unintended consequences.
I think you're exactly right, and that's what I'm suggesting we do on May 1st, have Lisa put things together, give departments an opportunity to come in. Well, the conversation for me, just so you're aware, Wayne, if we have a department or an office that needs us to appropriate dollars so that they can purchase things that were part of the budget process all the way through, I'm going to look at that really favorably. If, however, we're wanting to appropriate dollars so that a department or an office can spend ahead or buy something that was
right,
outside
that
of the budget process, I don't see that.
I agree.
And so that's what I'm suggesting we ask Lisa to put together, make sure that word gets out to all of our department and elected officials that that's what we're going to be talking about. And it's an opportunity to come in and just talk about where we are. We should be able to come out of May 1st with a really solid look at where we're going to end the year. And then that allows us to have conversations like, what are we going to do with video in this room? What are we, once we get to there with the items that we've kind of put on the list that said, okay, we're not budgeting for this, but if there's dollars available at the end of the year, we're going to make some of these decisions.
to me, that would all feed together, but the first part of that is figuring out what we have left that's actually budgeted.
So will you send out an email to the department heads and elected officials and let them know we'll have that discussion?
That's not May 1st or whenever that board
meeting. I think it's May 1st is that board meeting. Is that right, Shelley? Is it calendar-wise?
Why is that a board meeting?
Tuesday is May 1st.
It's May 1st, yes. Okay. Good, thank you. Drive safely. Thank you. And thank you, Brett, for calling that to our attention, making that adjustment. Appreciate that. Okay, would it be proper to have a motion from the board that I will not have to pay because you guys talked too much and took us over 12 o'clock, so I don't have to pay?
Guys, for lack of a second.
For the audience, they usually accuse me of talking all the time, and so the meetings are long. I think the day, that's not the case. So, Brett.
I have something to say to that.
All right. Veterans
that
Bears.
Microphone back and forth.
Yeah, it works. It works. It works. Just get it close to you.
The light doesn't work.
The light just doesn't work. But you can hear me fine. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to go first because I guess Brett wants me to. But anyway.
You look right in blue.
Anyway.
Normally I see you in red. On
I wore blue today. No, first of all, my name is Harlan Borton, and I'm a commissioner for Veterans Affairs. And I would like to thank each one of you as Board of Supervisors for taking the time to listen to my concerns over the past couple weeks. And also I'd like to thank Wayne as our liaison for coming to our meeting last Friday and laying out a plan that we feel that we can make useful. And as an advocate for the veterans of Story County, I feel that that's my duty to express my concerns. And I feel that you guys have done a lot to support us in the past, and we really appreciate you. And this is coming from all the commissioners, that we appreciate you working with us and laying out a plan for our new office. Right now, we have moved out of our present office into a temporary office next door, and we are going to be moving up the week of the 23rd, whether it's into our new space or whether it's going to be into a room in the back. But we will be up on the second floor right off the elevator just like we wanted, and thank you guys very much for that. And I feel that once we get our new office set, we'll have space to work with, and hopefully someday as we grow that we will get added space. But for right now, we're satisfied with what we got, and we want to thank you.
You're welcome.
We're glad to have you as a commissioner, man. You do a good job for the veterans.
Thank you.
Okay. Brett?
All right.
That's right.
That's all. You're done. I'll go ahead and go in with the quarterly report. The other two commissioners, our chairman is Chad Cook, and our member is Jennifer Rabine. Harlan Borton is our secretary this year. Our vision is to help ensure that veterans, our clients, receive timely access to the highest quality benefits and services we can provide, in which they earn through their sacrifices and service to our nation. We are in a temporary office. We're open for business. We're right off the elevator in the basement. For fiscal year 12, our third quarter, and I'm reporting from January to the end of March, we've approved just under county benefits 18 veterans or surviving spouses. We had five that came in for assistance, needing assistance with utility assistance. What we can't do is pay past due. We can't pay deposits. We can only pay current amounts. That was $721.08, and like Deb had mentioned on her report this morning, we are encouraging them to apply for LIHEA to get some help with their utilities. 10 veterans came in for rent assistance. Same thing there. We don't do deposits. We don't do past due. We do current rent and or home payments. That was $3,280. We're encouraging those folks to apply for HUD and SIRHA. One veteran came in for transportation, $43.21. One veteran came in for dental services. That was $74.
That included cleaning, x-ray, and an exam. And then we had a family come in for burial assistance for a veteran, $1,400 is what we assisted there. So total county assistance for the quarter was $5,518.29. Looking at the first quarter of this fiscal year, our assistance was $2,673. Second quarter was $3,538, just to compare quarters. And then I also went to look at the third quarter, the same quarter a year ago, and that was $7,344.22. So we're a little bit down from a year ago at this same time. We're a little bit up from the last couple of quarters. But still, our budget as of the end of March is right on the money at 75%. So we hit that little gate that I call it, and we're looking good on that. Now, on the total veterans that we've seen for the quarter was 259 veterans and or surviving spouses. 88 of those veterans were from World War II. 47 was from Korea. 43 Vietnam. 30 Persian Gulf. 17 in the areas of OIF, which is Iraq, OEF, which is Afghanistan, and OND, which is Operation New Dawn. And then we've seen 34 Cold War or peacetime veterans. This Thursday, I'm going to start work with the DOT. We're looking at transportation for veterans. And we're just kind of we're looking at this across Iowa in every county. I was probably chosen to go to these meetings because I'm in Ames and they're in Ames. And we're going to see what we can do in the state of Iowa for transportation in every county for veterans to get to the VA hospitals, to get to the CBOX. And for our area, of course, we have Des Moines, we have a CBOC in Marshalltown, we have a CBOC in Carroll, and we have a CBOC in Fort Dodge. So we're going to look at some of those issues and how the DOT might be able to help us out with getting veterans to their doctor's appointments. Got an update from the Iowa Veterans Home. I talked about this last quarter, I believe. They have completed construction in their Fox building, which is a four-wing building, 15 veterans in each wing. They each have their own bedroom with a shared kitchen, living room. There's no more roommates. There's no more the showers down the hall and standing in line with 40 other people to take a shower. They're getting away from all that. Eventually, they'll all have single rooms over there. Nursing care beds right now, there's 575, and we have 504 that are filled. Residential or the domiciliary is 113 beds. We have 105 filled there. Total capacity is 659. Astoria County has 7 folks that are over there. So we're looking at trying to get more outreach in the Iowa Veterans Home. A lot of people know that Iowa has a Iowa Veterans Home, and they know Iowa has a Marshalltown. They just don't know the Iowa Veterans Home is in Marshalltown. So we're trying to get that word out a little bit more, of course, with the assisted livings that we have and more people staying at home as long as they can with in-home health care. And then the other thing is with staying close to family and loved ones in nursing homes is probably the three biggest issues that a lot of folks don't choose the Iowa Veterans Home. But it is a home of choice, and it's an outstanding veterans home for Iowa. Iowa's ranked number 2 in the nation for the Iowa Veterans Home. If you ever get the time to stop over there, it's at 1301 Summit Street in Marshalltown, north side of town. 120 acres, you can't miss it. The Iowa Veterans Cemetery. Currently, we have 1,050 that are either buried or in a columbarium there. 905 of those are veterans, 145 are spouses. 32 states are represented. So even though veterans do leave Iowa, they seem to come back here for their final resting place. This is one place where we can make applications prior to the service. And currently, the state has on file 6,304 applications for veterans and their spouses that choose to be buried at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery. It's over by Van Meter. If you haven't seen it, off of Interstate 80, south side of Interstate 80, there by Van Meter. If you're in the area, stop by. It's a beautiful place. Along with that, to mention, there's some postcards that are being sent to veterans saying that they must buy a casket to, you know, from this company to have eligibility to be buried at the Iowa Veterans Home. Not true. Because of honorable service, veterans have eligibility for burial at the Iowa Veterans Home. You don't have to. So this is kind of a scam that's going. I mean, there's several.
Yeah, is the AG looking into this?
Pop up, yes.
Okay.
There's several that pop up. This is one of them where the veterans are getting postcards and they, I must call and I must buy this casket so I can be buried there. You know, so that's not true. And also, there's another group that's been going around. I haven't heard of them in Story County yet, but they are doing what we do in the office. We help veterans file claims. These folks are financial planners or consultants. The only thing is they're charging veterans not for filing claims, but they're charging them consultant fees. We file claims at no cost. It shouldn't cost a veteran or a surviving spouse money to file a claim,
right?
For one thing, and so they're charging up to $1,200. They are maybe, this isn't illegal. Matter of fact, they have an attorney with them. This isn't illegal, but it's surely unethical to move one's assets in places that they can't touch it. They can't get to them, and the reason for obtaining a pension to draw on federal dollars. It's kind of unethical on both sides there. And that's kind of what's happening. In other words, you're not eligible now because you have too many assets. We'll take care of that, and then you'll be eligible. And we'll help you file these forms. Actually, there was one veteran paid $1,200. They moved the money where it was, he couldn't get to it anymore. I'm not sure if he passed it on down to his kids. And 6-8 months later, because that's about how long these claims take, it was denied because he doesn't have qualifying service. Well, now what's he going to do? You know, he's out the money and all that. So we provide this service in our office at no cost, as well as every county in Iowa, to veterans and surviving spouses. So there's no need to have to pay to file a claim. Upcoming events.
Let me just interrupt just briefly. So what I'm suggesting that you consider through the commissioner is using every source of media that we have to get the word out. These are stories that the media would gladly pick up, and even the morning radio shows that we have locally, Des Moines Register, Angie Hunt, various others, certainly contact, Loris and in the local papers, because I think these are very important bits of information, and if they have questions, they can contact you for more information. I would even suggest that you see if you couldn't even get on the Channel 5 little blurb. Angie lives right here in Story County, and I bet she'd come out and gladly interview you and get this word out. I just suggest we do that as much as possible.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, we'll look at those too. Actually, there's another one I'm not going to mention today because I don't have enough information, but we're looking at those folks. They were at Walmart Saturday selling military hats, and taking donation for homeless veterans. And as of this morning, nobody ever heard of them before. So we're, you know, but they're gone. It was Saturday. They're gone now.
I saw him there probably a month ago.
Who do you call on set, you know? So they're gone, and so we're looking into all that. Upcoming events for the office. We have a spring school of instruction. Commissioner School's on the 24th of this month. And then Luke and I will be in a school the 24th, 25th, and 26th, state VA school. Vietnam Veterans Day at the Capitol will be May 7th at 12 p.m. Location will be the Vietnam Memorial on the south lawn of the state capitol grounds in Des Moines. Vietnam veterans, all veterans, supporters of veterans, grateful Americans are encouraged to attend this annual Vietnam Veterans Recognition Day. I believe we've been doing it since 2008, I want to say. You know, we found out about this. Harlan was walking down the street one day after they had this ceremony, and somebody stopped and I want to thank you for serving during Vietnam. And he said, well, thank you, but why are you asking me today? Well, because they heard about this Vietnam Veterans Day in Iowa. And so since then we've been trying to get the word out. We're still talking to Vietnam veterans. We've been doing it since 2008, and not everybody knows about it. Memorial Day events is May 28th. Normally each community basically repeats the same program each year, but as they come in, I'll try to get that out to the media so that the folks know and in their community what program is available. Ames this year will be honoring Iraqi veterans, so I'm looking for Iraqi veterans that like to be in a parade and be thanked for their services. The state Memorial Day program will be 8 a.m. May 28th at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery. Guest speaker is our governor, Terry Branstad. With that, I turn to after-hours programs. This is something that the whole commission is on this, and we volunteers. Our county treasurer is on the committee. We're looking at sending our World War II, our Korea, and our Vietnam veterans to Washington, D.C. for a day in October. We've even got the date picked out. The contract's being signed soon. And we have to send 10% to hold the October 9th. It's a Tuesday flight. So anyway, we got about 20 people on the committee with us. We're all excited. We're needing to raise some money. We're needing to find veterans. And currently I got 61 applications on file under review. 10 of them are World War II veterans. 24 are Korea veterans, and we have 27 Vietnam veterans. Now, we're going to kind of go in those orders. I mean, we want the World War II veterans to make sure we get all of them that want to go, that can go, feel like they can go, you know, for the day. It's a big day. We're going to start, you know, at O Dark 30 on that day, leaving Ames and going to the airport and flying to D.C., and touring around the World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Arlington, bus tours around D.C., back to the airport and come home that night. So there would be no motel that they would have to stay in. And we really like the support of which I know we will have, of when the buses leave Ames, to have our residents, whoever can come out that early to be on the side of the road. Hopefully we'll have a bunch of flags they can wave and give them a real good send-off. And I think that's a thing that they really deserve. And a lot of them that have gone, that's the thing that they really liked the most was the send-off part. Also, Sunday, October 7th, we're going to do a send-off program. And we're looking for the spot right now of where we could possibly talk to Jasper County. The treasurer at Jasper County has done three, working on his fourth one, And so Renee and I, we thought it'd be good to get him at a few of our meetings. The blueprint's already there. We just need to find the veterans and raise the money, and everything else is pretty much already in place. We just, and he has all the contacts that we need. So that's kind of where we're at on that.
Just a quick comment. Jasper County was the first county that went from World War II veterans to Korean veterans, and then they went to adding some Vietnam veterans. So Story County will be the second county in Iowa to do this. So we feel that we're right on top of things, and we're a leader in this, and we really feel that it's a much-deserved thing. The Honor Flight, they for every dollar that you make, they want you to send them 20 cents out of every dollar. But with us going by the Freedom Flight instead of the Honor Flight, we keep 100% of that money right here in Story County to help Story County veterans.
Now, we're calling it the Story County Freedom Flight 2012 in hopes that there will be another one. That's really the reason we have the year on there. We have a website with about all of our information will be on there, all of our events that we're having, and we have a few lined up already. It's Story County Freedom Flight, all one word, .org. So I encourage you to go to that that website, and you can stay up on our events that we're having. All right. Does the board have any questions for me?
No. Thank you. Thank you for your outreach.
One comment. We had an individual come in last Tuesday during the board meeting, and she wanted to express her appreciation for the job that you guys had done with her. Her husband had passed away here not too long ago, and you guys helped her through some paperwork and helped her get some benefits that she was entitled to that she wasn't aware of, and she was determined enough to thank one of us in person so we could get past you guys, as she sat through a good portion of the board meeting last Tuesday to wait and talk to one of us in person to let us know what a good job you guys did for her. So.
Okay, good.
And thank you. Normally I'd have a lot to say, but I'm going to pass in order to get Shelly up here.
You've already said it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay, Volunteer Center of Story County. Thank you, Shelly, for waiting.
Shelly, thank you so much.
We appreciate you being here.
Well, and this is my first time to give a report to the Board of Supervisors. So this is, I've never been to one of these meetings. It's been very educational. I apologize that I'm at the end of a long meeting and I'm making you sit there long.
That's okay.
What we're here for.
So the Volunteer Center of Story County, I don't know how much you know about it, so I'm just going to give you a few little details about it. This is our anniversary year. We're 30 years old now. We started out as a part of United Way of Story County, and then became an independent agency in the 1990s, about 1995. Most of our funding comes through asset funding. We also get grants, some state grants. We've gotten...
On the light on that one?
The light is on.
Okay.
Do I need to get closer?
Okay.
And thank you for approving the $500 that we get from the county. And I created a couple of handouts for you, and I will be referring to these. I always think that, you know, pictures help to convey a lot about things, especially if you don't know a lot about them. So what I am illustrating here is, I think, the things that we're doing throughout Story County. Our offices are in Ames, and we do a lot in Ames. There's a lot of volunteerism that takes place in Ames. But we also, we're at the Volunteer Center of Story County and try to serve the whole county as much as we possibly can. Now, we're a very small office. I'm the only paid staff member. We have volunteers, and I'm very fortunate to be able to utilize the services of AmeriCorps Vista members. And AmeriCorps Vista is the Domestic Peace Corps. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But it's a really excellent program, and we have some very dedicated young people who help us with that. So the Volunteer Center of Story County is sort of at its core links volunteers to nonprofits in the area. And on the back, you'll see of this colored sheet of paper, you'll see a listing of most of our 150 organizations that we serve. Some of them, most of them are 501c3s, some of them are more short-term organizations, but they all are doing something to make Story County a better place to live. So we really see that we're serving both volunteers and connecting them with the helping them to figure out what it is that they can do that's meaningful and helpful in the community, as well as help these nonprofits find volunteers so that they can accomplish their mission. And in doing all of this, we also have several kind of issue areas that we focus on. We're really focused on addressing issues of low-income residents of the community, so poverty, hunger, especially we're connected to that, looking at health and nutrition. I'll talk a little bit later about some of our garden projects. So I'm going to start at this upper right-hand corner picture and talk just briefly about each of these and then go clockwise. So in the upper right-hand picture, you'll see that in 2011, we had funds to have one of our AmeriCorps Vistas go to Maxwell and do some just basic community organizing in Maxwell. And what we did, we just kind of went there, we surveyed people in the trailer park, in the community, and said, what needs do you have, and, you know, what can we do, what kinds of things can we, as residents of Maxwell, do to make Maxwell a better place? So out of that, actually, it was just like, flame to, tinder. I just really burst with a huge amount of activity, and the residents ended up creating this organization called MARC. And I don't know, have you heard of it? Have you heard of Maxwell Area Renewal Community Committee?
Yeah.
And they're just a buzz of activity, and they've been looking at things like, since they hadn't had a sheriff or a police officer down there, they had increase in, like, vandalism and vagrancy and so on. Neighborhood watch program. They decided that they wanted to really, create Maxwell as a beautiful place to live. So what you're seeing here is some of the beautification efforts that they've done. And we helped them get grants to fund Day of Service, a national Day of Service, the 9/11 Day of Service and Remembrance that honors people who gave their lives on 9/11. So you'll see there some of the Maxwell residents painting the VFW hall, and 103, Maxwell only has about 800 residents, 103 turned out to volunteer, do things to beautify the downtown. There's some low-income residents that needed help in fixing up the exterior of their houses, doing things like that. It was really an outstanding, I think, event, and they are continuing. Maxwell or MARC is continuing and developing more projects for this coming summer. The next picture is something, it's a winter weatherization that we do in collaboration with Mid-Iowa Community Action and Central Iowa RSVP. We've been doing it for, I think this is going to be our sixth year, and so the idea is to send volunteers out to weatherize the homes of low-income residents. The next picture is the Story County Youth Philanthropists, and this is something we partner with the Story County Community Foundation this is a high school group, and it's open to all high school students in Story County. They apply, and what they do is they learn about philanthropy, and they learn about the organizations in the community, and then with funds through the Story County Community Foundation, $5,000, they grant those funds out to organizations, and then they follow up and see, okay, what did they do with them? So it's a really great way for kids to learn about the community and learn how to be a responsible citizen and how the community works. The next picture is of us in a classroom. We do a lot of work in the classroom through service learning, connecting youth to volunteer projects. Farther up, you'll see the Service Patch Community Garden. This is a community garden in Ames, and it's completely run by volunteers, and all of the produce is donated to food pantries or to low-income residents of Story County. And then at the top is the Story County Youth Volunteer Awards, and every year for the past, you know, I think this is our sixth year again. You know, we started a lot of things. I started here in 2006 with this, and so all of these really are new since I started. But the Story County Youth Awards recognizes the outstanding volunteer efforts of youth in Story County. So anyone under the age of 25 is eligible for nomination. So the other piece of paper that I gave you here is an invitation to the next Story County Youth Awards program. It's a really great program, and I'd love to have you come. As you can see there, the people who are being honored are from throughout Story County, and it's going to take place at the Iowa State University Memorial Sun Room, and Angie Hunt will be our MC for that event. We oftentimes have elected officials. I don't know if you've been able to come in the past, but we would love to have you come, and we would love to recognize you at the beginning if you do. So I know I rushed through that. I apologize for that. I know it's running late today, but I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you have.
No, again, just thank you for the leadership, and Story County is fortunate that we do have such an outstanding core of volunteers in a variety of programs. And in many cases, it's just finding things that they can still be engaged in, and they welcome this opportunity. The fellowship and the networking that comes from this in itself is marvelous. So, again, we appreciate all of this effort, and we'll try to see if we can look available on the 24th. We'll try to put that down
and
we can
great.
Get there.
Yeah, just want to reiterate, thank you for your work and all this. We've heard a lot about the work that Mark has done down in Maxwell, and actually you're using that somewhat as a model to try to take to other communities.
Mm-hmm.
But your work in organizing that has been outstanding, and everything else you guys do, you're a big part of what makes Story County great.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the agenda. Liaison, Paul.
I haven't heard anything from Alliance in the past few days.
Okay. Rick, anything?
Pass.
I met with Deb yesterday. She covered most of what we talked about in board proceedings today, so I won't need to go and reiterate that. With that, we're now down to consideration of personnel action listed here. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I skipped claims. How did that? That's second time I've done that. Let's move back up to the agenda. It's consideration of claims.
Move approval of the claims list.
Second.
Been moved and second the approval of the claims. Any further comments? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Now I know I'm in a hurry. Now consideration of personnel action. Up. Give you a second. Well, you got to get faster.
No.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Move approval of personnel actions.
Second.
Been moved and second the approval of the personnel action. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Personnel action is approved. Board, let me call your attention to a couple things. On the consent agenda, add number 19, please add road closures 1240 and 1241 to item number 19 under road closure. I would also want to call your attention to item 1, which is the consideration of the cancellation of the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday, April 17th, due to a lack of a quorum. And I would like to know, have a list of comment on items 9 and 10. Are there any other items that need to be pulled for discussion?
Can you tell us about 1240 and 1241 on item 19, the two additions?
Oh, okay. They were just, road closed, yes. Okay. Go ahead.
Section 25 on 663rd Avenue from Highway 210 to 325th Street for approximately a day. The road closure 41 is a culvert replacement in Indian Creek Township, Section 26 and 27 on 325th Street from 657th Avenue to 663rd Avenue for approximately one day.
Okay. Thank you.
And also, item number eight, if you guys have any questions on that, Margaret's here, and this is something that the Board of Health approved last Tuesday. It's a requirement that any contractor doing any work on a on-site wastewater treatment system be certified.
This is something Margaret talked to us about last week.
Excuse me. I think if we're going to do that, we'll have to pull it if we're going to do that. I'm sorry. I was just trying to alert to a couple of specific items. So why don't you just go ahead and we will pull that. And
I'll move the consent agenda with item 8 pulled.
Second.
It's been moved and second, the approval of the consent agenda with item 8 pulled. Sanders?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Clinton? Aye. Consent agenda is adopted. Now, item 8. Okay.
Didn't Margaret talk to us about this last week when she was reporting to us?
And we have to have a public hearing on this since it's going to involve an ordinance, that county ordinance that the Board of Supervisors is going to have to approve. But basically what it is anybody that's going to do any work on any wastewater, on-site wastewater treatment has to be certified. What'd you tell me, $300 or $400 for the class and $100 to take the test for the certification? Apparently there was even one private landowner that went through the class because he wanted to do his own work on his own system. But and the effective date won't be until July of 2015. So the contractors have 3 years in order to get their certification. And Margaret had a contractors meeting here a while back and discussed this topic. And she said there was a little bit of grumbling about it, but I didn't hear too much opposition. One of our Board of Health members is Mark Speck, who operates Speck Plumbing in Ames. He thinks it's a good idea that basically, Rick, you and I could go rent a backhoe and start putting in septic systems for people. And I guess we probably don't have any knowledge in that area, but currently the way it stands, that's the way it could happen here. So we're just looking for to get the certification, require that certification.
So what are we approving? If we've got to have a public hearing on this, what are we approving?
I think we have to set the date for the public hearing. It'll have to be through the Board of Supervisors because this board is the one that approves the ordinance.
Okay, but that will come to us at a later time as far as setting the date for the public hearing according.
I think we can set it now if we want.
I think I would ask that this come back to us on the 24th we handle this by itself and set whatever we need to set to get this pushed forward.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
To set the public hearing date, I believe.
To set the public hearing.
And just request that it go under additional items.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, so as far as the motion here, then, we're just talking about the consideration of the work that is done, and what you're basically telling us, though, is that in order to complete this, it has to be a public hearing. Okay, so actually no action then is really required at this time then, according to this.
You pulled it, we can just leave it.
Right. We can, it will be considered, what, at our next, on the 24th, is that correct? Is that what you're contemplating?
Margaret will put it on our agenda for the 24th to come back and be able to talk through and set a public hearing date.
Okay. Great.
For additional items.
Okay, so... And last but not least, since we've already approved the consent agenda, but let the chair acknowledge, first of all, appreciation under item number 17 to our conservation director, Mike Cox, and our assistant county attorney, Steve Owen, for their work on the professional service agreement with Shive Hatterley. I think in order to get this project moved forward and so forth, this was a very important piece, and it needed the assistance both of those two gentlemen, and I think we have arrived at a resolution that is acceptable to the county, and I certainly want to thank both of you for your work in this regard. So with that, we're ready to move on to public forum number two. Comments from the public on items not on the agenda.
We covered just about every topic, so it'd be tough to hit something that wasn't.
I didn't look at you, Nancy. Oh. Okay. Announcements from the supervisors.
Pass. Where are you taking us for lunch?
Motion to adjourn. Meet Casita.
Move adjournment.
Excuse me.
Move adjournment.
Move adjournment.
Second.
It's been moved and second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Meeting is adjourned.
Hey, can we push our meeting back to 3:00? You going to be around? Okay.